Kasten, freelance writer, UFO and metaphysical researcher, and author. Welcome, everyone. Trees Sheridan speaking, host of A Global Focus. Tonight's guest is Len Kasten. A Global Focus airs live on the International Paranormal Radio Network with its anchor station, UPRN 105.7 FM, New Orleans. Other listening venues include U.S. Stream TV, Live 365, Awcast, Shoutcast, and by mobile phone through dialing 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. Thank you to Joe Montaldo, owner of the Paranormal Radio Network, for making these broadcasts possible. This week's program features Len Kasten, freelance writer, UFO and metaphysical researcher, and author of The Secret History of Extraterrestrials, Advanced Technology, and the Coming New Race. A graduate of Cornell University, Len entered the U.S. Air Force Aviation Center cadet program. After his U.S. Air Force service, Len moved to Richmond, Virginia. Len extensively studied the Edgar Cayce material at the ARE, or Association for Research and Enlightenment, in Virginia Beach. While working in Washington, D.C., Len joined, in the mid-1960s, NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. At that time, NICAP functioned as the nation's major source of information for UFO reports. Len is president of the American Philosopher Society, again the American Philosopher Society, founded by Cyril Benton. Len served as editor of Metamorphosis magazine, co-founded by Gordon Michael Scallion, and as editor of Horizons magazine. As a feature writer, Len has written 52 articles, including 8 cover stories for the Atlantis Rising Machine, Atlantis Rising Magazine. Also, Len Kasten's website can be found at www.et-secrethistory.com. Len, thank you for agreeing to be a show guest. You come to this field with great expertise in both the ufological and metaphysical fields, and your book covers those fields in extended scope and detail, a wide spectrum of UFO and ET topics. Welcome.
Thanks. Nice to be here, Patrice.
The same. Now, Len, you preface in the first pages of your book the fact that you experienced a sighting while in U.S. Air Force service at a Gulf of Mexico facility. Now, this event seemed to make a lasting impression on you, and have other servicemen contacted you about similar experiences at other bases?
Well, I do get from time to time, I do get reports of such encounters, yeah. And as I look back on it now, I realize that it took me many years to realize that it really was an abduction scenario. It wasn't just a sighting, but it took me a while to realize that. But clearly that was the case.
Yes, I know of a report, a very interesting report that has come into me regarding a similar event, but I believe a different base. Now, Len, your contact segment of your book presents a number of interviews with either contactees or field researchers. Gee, there's so many I'd like to mention. Now, first of all, you've got a classic. You have George Adamski, and you provide a chronology of his reported UFO observations and contact. Does George Adamski strike you as a true contactee and someone of significance among the early contactees?
Yeah, he was a good example of the early contactees of the 50s. I think he was the most outstanding member of that group, although Van Tassel was also interesting and Howard Menger, but Adamski wrote extensively about it, and he's the most believable. And the incident that I recounted in my book is the classic encounter that he had in the desert with the extraterrestrial from Venus. And I wanted to make sure that I told that entire story because it tells you so much about Adamski and about the ET himself.
Yes, it does. You know what I thought was intriguing with that as well? You reference, and you go into great detail, that Adamski was joined by two Arizona couples, the Baileys and the Williamsons, who later became celebrated in ufology. These individuals agreed to follow Adamski into the desert, I believe near Desert Center, California. I guess Adamski was receiving this very strong impression to go there. But what I think is really interesting about their seeing the craft and later George seeing first a cigar-shaped craft, and then George spotting a disc is that, and then meeting with the terrestrial Orthon, is that this particular sighting seemed to be corroborated by a pilot report in Blue Book Special Report 14. You note that this report 14 related to a November 20th, 1952 incident, which seems to confirm the presence, at least, of an unidentified object in the Desert Center, California vicinity.
Yeah, right. So, you know, we got clear corroboration from Project Blue Book. It's I made sure and include that report in the book, and it's in the chapter. The fact that the military craft were circling overhead at the time, which Adamski did report, clearly made it into the Blue Book. So,
and you know,
they noticed there was a craft there.
And, you know, excuse me, you know, Len, I appreciate the fact, too, that you know that you utilize multiple resources for your research, and that added confirmation just adds a further stronger element to the account or the event.
Right.
Now, Len, I've had the I appreciate your summary of retired Army Command Sergeant Major Robert O'Dean, who, among his assignments during his military career, served at SHAPE, Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe. What an impressive individual. I've heard him speak twice. And, you know, and you beautifully recount the fact that he was able to see that cosmic top secret document, the assessment. And what was the name of it? Here it is right here. The assessment, oh, heavens, I had it right here.
Yes,
from the vault. Yes. And, well, regardless, it was an assessment of UFO presence, the UFO presence on the planet. And the gist of its conclusions is that at least four different extraterrestrial civilizations have visited Earth over thousands of years. The report allegedly expressed this finding with certainty. And the person who mentioned this report to him was a colonel.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. It was the cosmic top secret was it. Absolute top classified category, and he had that clearance. So the colonel let him read the report one night in the middle of the night when they were all bored and didn't know what to do, and that's how he came to read it. And after reading it, his whole life changed.
Now,
because,
you know,
this was a military study of UFO activity over Europe in the 60s.
Yes.
And they concluded indisputably that that we were being visited by four different civilizations.
Very powerful, and you beautifully describe that. You know, Len, if I remember correctly, Robert Dean also had a further extensive career serving both the military and also the government. But he and now, is it correct he also served at Fort Huachuca, an interesting fort? He really had a celebrated military career.
Yes, he did go to Huachuca. After he reenlisted, he was sent there and worked in. I'm not sure what his job was there. I have it on the article. But,
and that's an interesting fort, yes.
Yeah, but he didn't have the experience till he went to SHAPE headquarters in Europe,
mm-hmm.
following the assignment at Fort Huachuca.
Now, you know, too, what I think is interesting, and I am. Steen reports that a separate entity, the U.S. Aerospace Command, or USAC, since 2002, has existed for the conducting of space operations. The force is supposed to be comprised of service personnel from the U.S., Canada, and United Kingdom. Len, are you hearing confirmation of another Space Corps from contactees and researchers?
Space what, did you say? Repeat that question,
space
please.
Space Corps. Yes.
The U.S. Aerospace Command does exist, yeah. Dean told me that personally. He's a very good friend of mine, and he said that all of the space activities is being carried out now by the USAC. And they have their own personnel. They draw from the other services, and they draw from other countries as well. And they're out of Dugway, let's see, they're out of Vandenberg Air Force Base.
That's fascinating. Thank you. Vandenberg, yeah. California. Thank you, Lynn. You know, Lynn, I know Charles Hall, during an interview a couple of weeks ago on this network, made an interesting comment on a separate aerospace command. I believe under the U.S. aegis, but regardless, it was a separate command. It was fascinating. And, you know, to me, that type of information is very hopeful. But, boy, wouldn't it be wonderful to get the full details? It sounds like very interesting project material.
Well, you know the story of Gary McKinnon, the fellow in England who hacked
yes.
into the military, and he heard a conversation between two commanders of spaceships, just like on Star Trek. And,
yes.
They were communicating with each other as commanders of individual spacecraft. So he had that on tape. And I think they'd love to get their, they'd love to have him extradited to the United States because they really don't want that information known.
Well, it certainly would prove very controversial and also very exciting, though, in its own way.
Yeah, and what Dean said about the Aerospace Command is that it not only deals with defense and exploration of space, but they do have also a ceremonial, just like on Star Trek, they deal with ET visitors and with exopolitical relations. So they have a multifaceted role in our relationships with extraterrestrial visitations. And of course they do travel to the moon and to Mars on a regular basis. Bob confirmed that too.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Who confirmed that?
Bob did. Oh, Bob Dean.
Interesting. Well, his presentations are very informative, and he's certainly a senior statesman in the ufology field. I hope he will be presenting again soon. He was at the Scottsdale recent international UFO conference. And I'm hoping you will present very soon, too, again. Len, your book is among the top 50 of your publishers, way up there, around 18 or so. So I definitely would like to hear you speak in the very near future.
Oh, now, thank you. I spoke at the Kingman UFO conference recently. That was the last appearance I made, yeah.
Can I ask you a question? That Kingman, that famous site of another UFO crash, what was the presentation topic? And how did you like the conference?
Oh, it was great. It was the first year that they had it, so it was a small turnout. It was about 40 or 50 people, but they did take people out in a bus to visit the crash site, or what they thought was the crash site. It turns out that it was not really a crash. It was more of a landing in 1953 because the four entities on board were all in good shape and they were taken away by the military. There were four aliens that were taken away to Wright-Patterson, I believe.
Thank you for that. It was a very important
incident.
Well, thank you for saying that it was a landing rather than a crash. I'm wondering, too, if this dovetails into Michael Schratt's, that aviation historian and expert's presentation at Scottsdale, Iowa International UFO Conference. And he was mentioning that at the underground base there up at Area 51, among the models and the crafts was the Kingman. I believe, if I remember correctly.
Right, yeah, that one, that's right. He said that one was covered with a tarpaulin. And he
yes.
couldn't see it, but he knew it was from Kingman, yeah. And Michael also spoke at the Kingman conference also. He was there.
Boy, I would have loved to have heard both your presentations. Definitely next year. Now, you know,
mine was on Project
yes.
Serpo. I spoke on Project Serpo.
Oh, let's go to that. Now, Project Serpo is controversial, but it's fascinating. Now, let me see here. Project Serpo. Yes. Now, you give the name Operation Kryptonite under the Defense Intelligence Agency, and you report that in July 65, from the Nevada test site, a team of 12 astronauts, I guess, slash specialists, slash linguists, embarked for their voyage to Serpo. Now, there is an ongoing controversy as to the Serpo account. Which side do you think is gaining more favor in the eyes of the ufology community?
Well, I think there was a lot of skepticism at the outset, but we now have such a flood of detail that it's impossible that anyone could have made up all that detail. It's just too detailed, and it's been validated by so many different people that I don't think there's any further doubt about it. The fact that Steven Spielberg even made a movie about it, you know, Close Encounters, because he had a source, he had an information source also about this event. I'm absolutely certain that it took place.
Very interesting. Have you noticed as well that there is interest in the SERPO account, including from the French and internationally?
No, I haven't. I didn't know that. Are they showing interest in it as of late or what?
Yes, that Didier Duplège and his group. I'm trying to think of an interesting website, OVNI. Oh, I forget it right now, but I'll note it. It's Didier Duplège. He has an OVNI group and a great network program. I think that I could be mistaken here, but I think they were very much interested in the SERPO material.
And more people are getting interested in it, yes, as we go along. I have a full chapter in the book on that, and it's really an incredible story.
Yes, it is.
Really happened, yeah.
And you mentioned, too, that of our astronauts, I believe two remained on SERPO, but that even those who returned had rather an abbreviated lifespan because they were exposed to added radiation in that environment with the two suns and perhaps proximity to their suns, whatever.
Yes, right. That's correct. Most of them did die young. The last one died in 2002. They came back to Earth in 1978. They were given a full 1 year of debriefing, a full solid year of debriefing, and a 3,000-page book was written on the debriefing. And that book now remains at Bowling Air Force Base in Virginia, along with about 3,000 photographs. But it's very hard to get that material out of Bowling Air Force Base. They're not going to release it.
But thank heavens that there is the experience, the accounts, the research is memorialized like that. It's a blessing that those records do exist. And just off on a tangent, right now in our virtual auditorium we have many researchers, charming audience members, and now one of our important researchers from New York, Lily, has just referenced that Didier Duplège is also a member of the Open Minds Forum. So I'll have to check that out for SERPO.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. They took over the SERPO material, that's correct.
Yes,
yeah,
and of course... Yes, and of course, Didier Duplège is—he's a UFO expert. He would have know about many UFO fields. And pardon my interrupting.
But it should also be noted, though, that the original SERPO website is still there, www.serpo.org. That is also still out there, and that's got all the information on it. So anyone can get out there and take a look at it.
That's very, very good to know. And if I'm not mistaken, a key organizer of that, of just distributing that material or memorializing it on the web site was that co-founder of Project Camelot.
That's right, Bill Ryan. Yeah, Bill Ryan was the one that that created the website and faithfully reported everything that was sent to him by the DIA, the ex-DIA officials who released mm-hmm. the information in November of 2005. That's correct.
You know, Len, with this new information on Project SERPO, it's even more intriguing than I thought it was previously. Thank you.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. It really is.
And also, please feel free to speak right over on me. I get up at 5 o'clock to be in the office at 7 on the weekdays, and by this time I've had 3 cups of coffee, so at least, maybe 4. So if I interrupt, please just override me. Seriously. Len, you mentioned a figure in ufology who has provoked great controversy. He is Dr. Michael Wolff, an alleged MJ-12 member. You report that he spoke of a, quote, satellite government, end quote. You also reference that he alleged to have worked side by side with humans and ETs in underground government facilities. And I have to read that copy of Catches of Heaven. What do you think about Dr.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, you can get Catches of Heaven on Amazon, but it's $144.
Wow.
They're all
mm-hmm.
used copies. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. very expensive, but they have 6 copies out there. That's the only place I know of where you can get it now.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're willing to pay $144 to read it, but it might very well be worth it.
That's true, too. Now, Len, you also mentioned Dr. John Mack's excellent work at attempting to interpret the experiences of those contacted or abducted by ETs. You mentioned you wanted that new perspective to research these matters, and a new dimension was reported by the experiencers. And I hadn't realized that Dr. Mack of Harvard was reporting on hybrid development. I have to read his book, Passport to the Cosmos. I never have. It's a must read. Your further comments on that?
Well, Mack was, of course, the most outstanding exponent of the hybrid of the abductions. He had hundreds and hundreds of cases that he used the hypnosis with, and he was absolutely convinced that the abductions took place. What makes his report so believable is the fact that he was a psychiatrist, a Harvard-trained psychiatrist. He knew what he was doing, whereas Bud Hopkins was an artist and didn't have the credentials, so a lot of people didn't really believe Bud Hopkins, but nobody can really argue with Dr. Mack. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. As you know, he was hit by a truck in London a few years ago and died at a rather young age. I'm glad I had that chapter in there. Yeah, I have a whole chapter on Mack's work.
Very well said, and it's an excellent chapter. Your book is excellent. Now, Lynn, let's turn now to Jesse Marcel. I did have the honor of meeting Colonel Jesse Marcel the day I visited the Skip site, one of the Roswell event sites, with UFO researchers and archaeologists Chuck Sukowski, Debbie Ziegelmeyer, and team member Matt. I will never forget Colonel Marcel's focused, thoughtful look when we actually visited that site. I can tell you're impressed by Jesse Marcel, aren't you?
Well, Jesse Marcel was definitely the key figure in the whole Roswell story, because he was the base security officer, and for him to make that admission to Stanton Friedman, you know, that he had to be telling the truth, because he was close-mouthed about it for 30 years before that interview, but he finally broke the story to Stanton Friedman in 1979, and that's when all the information started to come out.
You know, you mentioned excellent points from Jesse Marcel, Colonel Jesse Marcel Jr.'s book, The Roswell Legacy. You mentioned
right.
The fact that his father carefully tried to draw the hieroglyphic type characters, the material from the crash site on that the crash articles that bore those hieroglyphic type characters. What are your thoughts on that? I'm going to just go to your book here because I'm not properly describing this.
Well, the article is basically about the fact that his son wrote the book.
Yes.
Based on what he saw that night when he was just 11 years old, when his father came home and dumped all these strange articles out on the kitchen floor.
Yes.
These items from space, and his father was convinced that they were from... non-earthly vehicle, and so Jesse Marcel Jr., when he retired from the army himself, wrote the book that that I talked about in my book.
Thank you very much for that further explanation. And just to make sure that I'm referencing here your book, excellent pages 54, 55. You mentioned the fact that it was about the beam. The beam was one of the articles, and he said, quote, on the inner surface, there appeared to be a type of writing. The writing was a purple-violet hue and had an embossed appearance. The figures were composed of curved geometric shapes. It had no resemblance to Russian, Japanese, or any other foreign language. It resembled hieroglyphics, but had no animal-like characters, end quote. And that was from Jesse Marcel, Junior's affidavit, signed in March 1991, in which he described the material his father had brought home. One thing, and I promise not to be too lengthy on this, but Len, Colonel Jesse Marcel Junior's, both the father's career was outstanding, and the son's career as well. Jesse Marcel Jr. is a retired full-bird colonel. He served his nation for 38 years. Let me see, that's just
These are only a few of the bulls here. Jesse Marcel was called back to service in October 2004 at the age of 68 for active duty service as a flight surgeon with the 189th Attack Helicopter Battalion in Iraq. During his Iraq War service, Jesse Marcel Jr. flew more than 225 hours of combat duty aboard a Black Hawk helicopter. To me, he's truly a hero, and he is now an otolaryngology specialist at the VA hospital in Montana, Fort Harrison. Boy.
Right, that's right. Mm-hmm. The book that he wrote the book in, let's see, I think it was in 98, I believe, and it didn't get published under its original name. It got published under a different name, but it is available now on Amazon. The Roswell, it was originally called The Roswell Legacy.
Yes.
But then it was republished as, let's see, what did he have it as? Let's see, he had it as, it was written, co-written, it was co-written with another author, and the name was changed. It was called The Untold Story of the First Military Officer at the 1947 Crash Site. And it was co-authored with Linda Marcel, who I believe is his mother, and Stanton T. Friedman. So that should be noted.
Yes, it should be. And thank you for that. That sounds like a wonderful to check that out as well. That's a
wonderful tip there. You know what I found very intriguing too, Len? I was happy to see you mention the work of David Flynn, author of Cydonia, The Secret Chronicles of Mars. Now, David Flynn...
Do you know him? You know him?
I do.
David Flynn?
I've met him. I've had the pleasure. David is a messianic. He and his wife are both messianics. He's a wonderful historian and analyst of mythology, history, sacred geometry, architecture, and other subjects to produce riveting theories. He's like you. He's a Renaissance type. I can tell you were impressed by David Flynn's work, weren't you?
Definitely, very definitely, and that's why I wrote the story. Now, when I wrote the article for Atlantis Rising, I didn't think it would be included in the book, but the publisher really wanted that in the book, and they really liked that particular chapter. Yeah, I think he's a brilliant guy, David Flynn, definitely. And I don't think he's had actually a book published. He self-published one of his own books about Cydonia. I don't think that's any longer in print. But I was so impressed by his presentation at the Roswell, in Roswell, called the 4th of July that year, that I interviewed him for the magazine, and that became a chapter in the book. That's quite a story, and he really puts it in perspective. He really puts the whole incident into historical perspective. It's very important.
He does, though, and with his great knowledge of sacred geometry, geography, geology, architectural structures, it's really quite a compilation. He comes up with very interesting theories. And they're well argued too.
That's right. He does what Paul LaViolette does. He puts everything into the context of mythology, which is very important because the ancient myths, there was a lot of truth in those myths, and he relates to those, and you get a whole different viewpoint that way. And there are very few people that can do that, and Flynn is one of them, and also Paul LaViolette, who I also discuss in my book.
Yes, you do. And, you know, not only with other aspects of advanced technology, but one chapter really is fascinating. It's the fact that Paul LaViolette believes that possibly the pulsars serve as warning beacons by advanced extraterrestrial civilizations. Where's my note on
right.
It? It was fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. And, you know, Paul's a scientist, and he's a terrific, also very, very, very much into metaphysics as well. But, you know, it all makes sense because the only other theory that it competes with is the fact that what they call the lighthouse model theory of pulsars, which is that these tiny little packed, burned-out suns are spinning at such a high rate of speed that they pulse a signal that appears to be a pulsar. That just doesn't make sense at all, I don't think. But I think Paul's theory that the pulsars are warning beacons put there by intelligent civilizations to warn of what he called the galactic superwave that sweeps throughout the galaxy and causes tremendous cataclysms. And it would make sense that other civilizations would want to warn other star systems of the fact that this superwave has been propagated and is heading their way. That makes more sense as a rationale for pulsars than the other theory, which I don't think makes any sense at all to me.
And you know, you're good enough too as well, Len, not to only summarize it very well, but you mentioned the work of Dr. LaViolette on that called The Talk of the Galaxy, where he proposes that pulsars could be extremely advanced technology by ETs seeking to warn of these galactic events, as you note. Boy, your advanced technology section was fascinating. Pardon me, getting over cold from last week. First of all, you referenced Dr. Paul LaViolette's work, Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion, Tesla, UFOs, and Classified Aerospace Technology, and Dr. LaViolette's chronology and explanation of the anti-gravitic technology. That's an interesting section. It's very well worth reading. Let me see here, Len. You also mentioned the foundational work of Thomas Townsend Brown. T. Thompson Brown, thank you.
The most preeminent pioneer.
Gravitics.
He was the pioneer, all right.
And that was of gravitics research and development. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was involved in actually at the age of he took out his first patent in anti-gravity technology at the age of 17 in the 1920s. That's how he was way ahead of the game.
What achievement. Mm-hmm. Now,
and LaViolette talks about him extensively in his book.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Now, Len, you reference in your book the work, The Philadelphia Experiment, by William Moore and Charles Berlitz. Do you believe that the event, The Philadelphia Experiment, actually occurred, or are you tending towards that opinion?
I believe it actually happened, yeah, I do. And I think that's what contributed to T. Townsend Brown having his nervous breakdown shortly after the incident, and having to leave the Navy. The naval physicians advised him to leave the Navy because of that breakdown, and that was logical that he would have been very, very upset by what happened, because, as you know, if you read about that experiment, some of the sailors came back actually embedded into the steel hull of the ship. It was a horrible outcome, and I think that after that, Townsend Brown didn't want any part of that experimentation.
That would be really frightfully horrible to anyone, very traumatic. Now, you know, Len, on your section on extraterrestrial technology, you reference that Herman Oberth, I hadn't heard of this gentleman, O-B-E-R-T-H, Herman Oberth, a pioneer in rocket science, referenced to others that we were helped by people of other worlds. And you also referenced that our B-2 bomber could have benefited from anti-gravitic technology.
Right. That's correct. I have two chapters on that. One about an investigator by the name of Tony Gonsalves, who did a tremendous job of research and came to that conclusion. And also then 10 years later, Paul LaViolette wrote about it in his book, Anti-Gravity Propulsion. So I don't think there's any question about it anymore that the B-2 indeed does have anti-gravity technology built into it. I'm absolutely convinced of it.
Well, you give some very interesting arguments there. You mentioned that Northrop was awarded the B-2 contract in 1981, and I know that your scientific knowledge is far more advanced in comparison with mine, but you mentioned that it had interesting aspects of a specific electrification of a wing-shaped structure for aerodynamic qualities, and also that there were the four GE-100 jet engines seeming to incorporate that flame jet principle of T. Townsend Brown.
Right.
That's interesting.
That's
mm-hmm.
Brown realized, you know, some very high electrical voltages were needed to power these craft. He came up with a plan for a spaceship that would use the flame jet engines to actually act as electrical generators. That would allow them to power the electrogravitics part of the craft. So it was an all enclosed system. The jet engines were actually creating electricity to power the electromagnetic portion of the ship. And he came up with that in Project Winterhaven, and eventually I think the B-2 bomber did incorporate those principles. Interestingly enough, the term B-2, Brown worked with his professor, whose name began with B also, and they were instrumental in developing this technology, and Le Violette is of the opinion that that's where the term B-2 comes from, because both their names began with B, and it makes a lot of sense, actually.
Thank you very much for that clarification. Now, one of our senior in knowledge, not in age, researchers, Lily from New York is asking, was Oberth part of Operation Paperclip or prior thereto?
I don't think that Oberth was part of Operation Paperclip. He came over as a scientist, but not as an ex-Nazi. All the Paperclip scientists were Nazis whose records were all cleaned up by the CIA. But Oberth was, I think he was of such stature that he was an international scientist. I don't believe he was part of Paperclip. But he did know that aliens were involved in helping us to develop a lot of this technology. And that's why he made that statement.
Thank you. Intriguing. Now, you know, you had referenced Tony Gonsalves, and you mentioned his research and the fact that Tony Gonsalves would be an aviation expert. He was a former plane captain on the aircraft carrier, the Midway. And he believes that the Hudson Valley UFO sightings actually were a B-2, but you also go into a discussion where it could have been a B-2, but that there were two types of B-2s, and that the one seen during the Hudson Valley, if that were a B-2, would have the more advanced technology.
Right, and Tony's viewpoint was that they were stalking the Hudson Valley at night to see if they could be passed off as UFOs, because this was before the B-2 was actually put into production. This was in the early 80s, and the book, Tony's contention was that the book Night Siege, which reported on those sightings in the Hudson Valley, that they were actually seeing the B-2 bomber, and he gave a lot of evidence for that. And so I decided to make that, I actually made that an article for Atlantis Rising, and then it became a chapter in the book.
Very interesting reading material. Now, you also note that the B-2 project was a special access required development project of prime importance, but also prime secrecy.
Right, exactly. It was in unprecedented secrecy. The development of the B-2, the secrecy was incredible. They were told that they couldn't even dream about it, the workers. They were not even allowed to dream about it.
That does seem to be very, very intense.
Yeah, and I think we've already used the B-2 in warfare. I think it was involved in the first Gulf War. Mm-hmm. I'm certain that the bombing of Baghdad, that very first bombing of Baghdad, was that B-2s were involved in that.
Well, it would seem like a very credible argument. Very credible argument. Now, you know, Len, like myself and many others, I can tell you appreciate the groundbreaking work of Linda Moulton Howe, a journalist with excellent academic and media credits. Now, you're correct that Linda investigates these files and the matters in an intrepid and detailed manner. It sounds to me as though one of your favorite works of Linda's is the High Strangeness work, the volume 2 of
right.
Glimpses of Other Realities. Did that most greatly impress you of all her material?
Yeah, I think so, because she covered a lot of ground in that book and made a lot of revelations that nobody knew about before she wrote the book. She's a very thorough investigator, and when she gets into something, she does a good job. Plus, she's got some very important contacts in the military, and they provide her with a lot of very, 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 very valuable information. So that's why.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's why I wanted to make sure I included a chapter about her in the book, and what she talked about in High Strangeness, which was a fantastic book.
Len, do you think that her field standing and gravitas permit her to receive many testimonies from military as well as our citizens?
I think so. I think they trust her. The military trusts her that she will report on these phenomena very faithfully and very carefully. They know that already. And if you go to her website, earthfiles.com, you'll see that right away. That she takes great pains to be very, very careful in everything she reports on. Very impressive journalist. And that's why she was an Emmy Award-winning TV producer.
Yes, several media awards. Too, what I thought was very notable was the fact that after these conferences, she always takes time to answer questions from the audience, and people will go up to her and mention their experiences and accounts, and she always hears their account or answers their question in a very professional and courteous manner. Remarkable person.
Yeah, that's right. And she listens carefully because she learns. She's always interested in learning some new facts that she can only get from people in the audience frequently.
Yes.
And
she's very
open to that, you know.
I think so, too. Now, Len, your material on crop circles, too, presents some interesting new theories. Now, you know that some of the images could be made in an inexplicable manner, but that several may have been made by humans with the help of computer programs and even satellites.
Yeah, that was the conclusion of Colin Andrews, who was the main authority on crop circles. He's been around a long time, and I interviewed him way back, right after he got involved in it for the magazine. At that time, this was in 1997. At that time, when I first interviewed him at his home in Connecticut, he had no. He gave me no indication that he thought they were being produced by humans. But when I interviewed him the second time, in 2002, I believe it was, he had come to the conclusion that 80% of the crop circles were made by humans, and that was the result of a 2-year investigation financed by Lawrence Rockefeller. That he came to that conclusion. He shocked the entire crop circle world, really, with that revelation, and I had trouble with it myself because it's just hard to believe that humans could have produced those glyphs. It just didn't make sense. But, you know, he was convinced of it, and when I interviewed him, he stuck to his guns about it. So the crop circle that I wanted to get his opinion on was the one where the alien face was a crop circle showing an alien face in the wheat. And to me, it seemed impossible that could have been made by humans because it was so complex. But he said he thought it was.
Well, you know, I think that's an excellent point you make. I believe that another expert contends that the alien face, and this is just a very rough paraphrase with the message, beware the bearer of gifts or some such, the portal is closing, if I remember correctly, this is a very rough paraphrase, actually might have been man-made and not made through extraterrestrial agency.
Well, if it was man-made, it was done with some very sophisticated and highly computerized. I mean, you can say that they're man-made, but don't forget these are made overnight. These things are made overnight, so they're made very quickly. So if they are man-made, they have to be done with some kind of very high technology. And certainly it would have to be computerized. It would have to be perhaps even involving satellites. I don't know. But he, as I said, he was convinced that that particular one was man-made, and most of the others, 80% of them. Of course, there are the other 20% that he couldn't account for. So what do we do with those?
And you know what I think is really interesting, too, is the fact that you mentioned the possibility of, in those inexplicable crop circle formations, the possibility of plasma vortices creating some of these crop circles. And, you know, that recalls an account by Nancy Talbot of the research group BLT, viewing the formation of a crop circle. It was remarkable. I believe the incident occurred at the family farm of Dutch psychic Robert van den Broecke. And the way she described it, I don't know, or elsewhere in her research, I believe that she's referenced that plasma connection. And here, plasma vortices.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that Colin did talk about that, as I recall. I think I mentioned that in the article, in that chapter, didn't I? I think I
mentioned that. Yes, you did. Mm-hmm.
Right. And, that, you know, the plasma theory does make a lot of sense because plasma technology is very complicated and very very strange. But nevertheless, how do you generate these vortices? I don't know. I don't know if we have any technology that can do that. Maybe we do. If we do have it, certainly it would be in the hands of the military. It wouldn't be in the hands of any civilian agencies. No?
That's for certain. That's for certain. Now, you know, before the break, we have about 8 minutes left, and I was hoping we might be able to just touch upon the exopolitics segment of your book. Your material and Dr. Michael Sala introduce new information here, concepts. You do mention Dr. Sala's scholarship, impressive academic and arbitration mediation background, which rightfully recalls just how brilliant his career accomplishments in the university and at diplomacy projects have been. Now, this is the new information, or at least it's new to me. You referenced Dr. Sala's thoughts on the Iraq War, including a scenario where the Russians, French, and Germans allegedly may have been assisting Saddam Hussein in attempting to unravel technology on an apparatus left by the Anunnaki. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, other people have made similar claims, and Sala was not alone in this, although it does appear to be outrageous that we would have invaded Iraq just to get our hands on that piece of equipment. But he's absolutely convinced that that's what happened, and that was the reason for the Iraq War. That there was a Stargate there in the city of Uruk, which is mm-hmm. the very ancient city of Mesopotamia, and that the U.S. government wanted to get their hands on that Stargate, and that was the reason for the urgency, because they felt that it was necessary to get it in 2003 because a lot of the military believed that we were going to be visited by Planet X in 2003. That theory was floating around, and I think a lot of them believed it. And so that's what made that such an urgent date, because there was no reason why they had to hurry up and invade Iraq in 2003. If it was all about oil, it wouldn't have made sense. And that was Sala's theory. That was his theory. And he expounded on that in a 10,000-word article on his website.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dan Burrish references cylinder seals. Am I correctly remembering that, recalling that, cylinder seals?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were I think it was 5,000 of them in the museum in Baghdad. And the museum was looted over a 4-day period. The Marines failed to defend it. So the question is, who looted it, and why didn't the Marines defend it? Certainly they were there. They could have defended it. And Sala's theory, and one I reported on, was the fact that we perhaps wanted to get our hands on those cylinder seals. And because they were able to point to the technology involved in the Stargate.
Well, you know, Dr. Sala, from your book, I received a very strong impression, and also from reading Dr. Sala's articles myself, that he does believe that there is exopolitical-based intrigue and competition occurring among the world's nations. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think there's any question about it. You know, certainly we've been dealing with aliens for a long time. at least since the 50s, at least since the 50s, possibly since the 30s. Clearly, Hitler was involved with them in the 30s, and that they helped him develop a lot of the technology that was used in World War II and other technologies that they didn't get a chance to use in World War II. So if we've been involved with them, if Germany's been involved with them, it's almost certain that the Chinese have been involved with them. Fowler's position is simply that extra-political deals have been made all over the planet at very high levels, and that it's an ongoing thing, and it's, of course, top secret. Nobody is spilling the beans. So that's basically what he's saying. Basically, is exopolitics is already being practiced. It's a question of really making it public and involving the democratic societies rather than keeping it in the hands of the military, which is where it is now.
Well, those arguments are certainly they're based on reasonable elements. You know, even if you wouldn't fully agree with them, they're reasonable elements. And you know, I find it a little unusual that Dr. Sala was unfortunately he was importuned, should we say, by that controversy over Source A and the alleged UN meetings on the ET subject matter. I don't know if you're familiar with that. I probably shouldn't go into it at great length, but I really wondered if that was a setup.
Tell me again what happened there. I'm not sure I recall that.
Well, the source A that was supposed to be so vital to the testimony here on alleged UN meetings on the ET subject matter turned out to be someone who more or less was mockingly presenting himself as Source A. And it wasn't until people realized that he wasn't whom he alleged to be, that he didn't have the quite the background he said he had, until after the fact, and some odd photos showed up, that the entire account on the UN meetings was really put very much in question. And I just wondered, hadn't heard anything about that?
Vaguely, I recall that. What was Sala's involvement in that exactly?
I think he might have just maybe analyzed what was going on there. Nothing more, but just analyzed it.
Right.
And at the time,
so many people. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
At the time, he probably, given Source A's connections with certain groups there, I believe, in the New York area, he would have assumed that he was a valid member, service member of these groups. One would
right.
think that the groups would check the credentials of their members, and to me it was
right.
just all too bad.
Well, you know, there are so many people out there that are trying to debunk and to shoot down this valuable information that he was fair game, evidently, mm-hmm. and somebody decided they were going to try and discredit him, and I think that's probably what happened.
That's what I'm thinking, too. Now, you know, Len, we have a kind of a countdown here, about 30 seconds. We'll have a 10-minute break. And I just wanted to mention everyone here while we're getting our coffee or other beverages, cookies, whatever, please feel free to look at Len Kasten's website, www.et-secrethistory.com. At his website, you can find the ordering information for his book, The Secret History of Extraterrestrials, Advanced Technology, and the Coming New Year. Back in 10 minutes for our second hour of the interview with Len Kasten. Thank you, Len. Looking forward to speaking with you in 10 minutes.
Okay, Patrice. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Welcome back to the second hour of A Global Focus, with guest Len Kasten, freelance writer, UFO and metaphysical researcher, and author. Welcome back, everyone, to our second hour of our interview with Len Kasten. It's certainly been a very informative discussion, and we still have at least 55 more minutes to go and several questions here. Let me see if I'm going to try to read them in reverse order. There's so many. Now, let's see here. We've had questions here on the crop circles. We have one of our senior but not in age but experienced ICAR researchers mentioned the fact that he's noted discussion of microbursts in the stems with the crop circles and the mutant seed heads, but he's wondering if crop circles are a viable explanation of ET. And one of our other researchers here, also a musician, is wondering why ETs would use modality of a crop circle to communicate with us.
Well, my theory on that is, and this has been expressed by, I think Bob Balam talked about it and some others, that the best way to get through to the subconscious is through symbols. And the aliens understand that. And that more information can be conveyed with a single symbol than perhaps thousands of words. Mm-hmm. And because it goes right into the subconscious, because the subconscious appreciates symbology and is able to understand symbology. And to me, that's the reason that they're doing this. And a lot of information is being conveyed to us, even though we don't even realize it, just by looking at those crop circles. I am not of the opinion that they're made by humans. I know that Colin Andrews does think that, but I'm still convinced that they were made by ETs.
Because of their intricacy and the established changes in the seeds themselves and the crops themselves.
And the messages that they've conveyed, and also the fact that they were done so quickly. They were done, overnight, literally in a matter of minutes in some cases.
That would be an argument, too. There are definite arguments for non-human agency for these crop circles. On another subject matter, our New York Lily, our researcher from New York City, the New York City area, asks, how many ET races do you think are coming here, and do you think there are any UTs or beings from other dimensions coming here as well?
Well, Bob Dean says that the SHAPE report that he read in 1964 stated with absolute certainty that there are four civilizations visiting us, and they have been coming here for thousands of years. And Bob said that one of them, according to the report, looks exactly like us, to the point where that you could sit next to them on a bus or a plane, and you would not know that they were from another planet. So we know about four at least. Then Michael Wolff claimed that there were perhaps six different variations of the Greys alone. That there were the tall Greys, the short Greys, there were some that acted like robots, and then we have another group called that Michael Wolff called the Orange Race, that supposedly have six fingers and toes, and one of their crafts also crashed in New Mexico. So I don't know how many are coming here, but we have reports of people, of entities that look like large insects. We have all kinds of reports. And my own feeling is that probably there are perhaps 20 races that have been coming here at various times, at least.
Thank you for that thoughtful answer.
According to Michael, I think it was Michael Wolff who said, this is a very popular tourist attraction in the galaxy for some reason. So that might explain it. They find us very interesting creatures.
Thank you. This is very intriguing.
Yeah.
Now, Fourth Kind, one of our researchers and a researcher of great expertise in some of the Colorado events, and also he's done wonderful studies with abduction. Fourth Kind has this following question. How far back do you think does the history of ETs begin? Have they been around since the beginning of time, like some people claim, or just since World War II, when we started detonating nuclear devices in the mid-1940s?
Well, I think von Daniken has demonstrated clearly that they've been coming here for a long time. And in my interview with Robert Bovall, who discovered the Orion, the star system, the Orion stars that mirrored the three pyramids of Giza, they probably had a lot to do with the building of the pyramid, the Great Pyramid of Giza, and with the high Egyptian civilization. So I would say thousands of years. How many thousands, I don't know. You know, the Mayan calendar began 3013 B.C., and many people believe that that calendar was started with the help, that those early civilizations were involved with ETs. So, and they helped to build those Central American civilizations, the ancient civilizations. So, I don't know how long. I don't know how long. You know, the Indian race that preceded the Hopi, the Anasazi, they were here for 10,000 years before the Hopi appeared. There's some very ancient history here, and a lot of it is ET related. The plains of Nazca, a lot of the ruins in Central America, they all testify to a very, very ancient ET legacy, and I'm in perfect agreement with von Daniken and with Sitchin on those points.
Thank you. The research has been very intriguing, hasn't it? Now, boy, we've got a couple questions left, and then there's so much, actually, I'd like to ask you, Len. Your expertise does extend the full spectrum. You mentioned Dr. Stephen Greer in your book, his interesting career path from emergency room physician to the leading international disclosure advocate. And you know, proactive projects of Dr. Greer, and you know, it was a nice a recall for me as to his accomplishments, and he has accomplished much there. Also, you preface it with Congressman Stephen Schiff from New Mexico. Apparently, his constituents wanted answers on Roswell, and Schiff actually received, as you note, a response from the General Accounting Office, a report back in July 1995, that the documents had mysteriously disappeared 40 years prior.
That's right. Yeah, they were gone. All the Roswell documents were no longer there. Now that in itself is, I think, a little incriminating, don't you think?
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And
so, it was very convenient that they were no longer there.
And they certainly would have been.
Schiff's investigation was financed in part by Lawrence Rockefeller, who was involved with that also, as well as with Colin Andrews. And I was part of the protest movement in Washington at that time, protesting to have those documents, released. But and then he died mysteriously at a very young age of a very aggressive form of skin cancer. So that's kind of mysterious, too.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It gives one pause, definitely. You know, and you note the different achievements of Stephen Greer, his founding Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and also in August 1995, his publishing an intriguing paper, that National Security Implications of the UFO ETI Subject.
Right.
You know what really floored me, and I had forgotten this, that back in November 1996, under the aegis of the CSETI project, he actually sent a letter to the president and all top government officials. You referenced that unless the letter received written objections by these parties, all security oaths taken by government officials, I guess here to include military and intelligence personnel, would be considered null and void since they violated legal constitutional norms. That's fascinating.
Right, and he asked them to, if they object to that, to send back a letter stating that objection, and nobody objected. So he went ahead with Project Disclosure. He didn't get any negative replies. He took the position that all of those security oaths were unconstitutional. And therefore, they should be all relieved of those oaths and be free to divulge this information. And so, since they didn't object, he started Project Disclosure. And I made a point of that in the book.
Yes, you did. That January 1st, 1997 was proposed as the date when those security oath holders would have the freedom to speak, barring any contrary directions. Interesting material.
Right.
Interesting material, then.
Yeah. Greer is a real pioneer and a real groundbreaker, and you know he's done a lot for the movement. There's absolutely no question about it.
I agree, and you know one thing I've forgotten was that the National Press Club meeting in 2001 was with the impressive witness testimony broadcast on live TV network. However, it did experience significant jamming of the broadcast.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So there again, there's some little bit of sabotage there going on. No question about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the entire transcript is available on his website for anybody that wants to listen to it. It's out there.
Thank you. That's an excellent source. I agree. That testimony is very important, and it was a wonderful initiative. Now, you know, Len, you also mentioned the Majestic 12 documents. You referenced Stanton Friedman, Robert and Ryan Wood, Linda Moulton Howe as proponents of the Majestic 12 documents' validity. Do you still remain very impressed by the documents' validity, their bona fides?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Harry Truman, what is a president going to do when he learns that an alien spacecraft has crashed into the New Mexican desert? He himself had no scientific background. The most logical thing to do was to scour the country for the 12 experts that could help him make some sense of what was going on. And he did. He had top scientists, top military intelligence people on the original MJ-12. It was the right thing to do. It was the only thing to do. It was the logical thing to do. I have no doubt that he did it. And, of course, we have the documents now. The Woods... Ryan and Bob Wood have the documents, and they're out on their website.
And they've done extensive analysis on them indications of credibility.
And so does Stanton Friedman. He's convinced, too.
Mm-hmm. That's a very, very good point, Len. Now, you know, you also, I found this intriguing. You have a very thoughtful chapter on the hybrid aspect of the ET subject matter. Now, you mentioned the Hopi material, very interesting, also Miriam Delicato's advocacy of the Hopi concepts. She's a remarkable lady. I've had the pleasure of meeting her. She's very intelligent, very sincere.
She's a friend of mine. I know her very well.
Mm-hmm. She's a lovely lady, very, very bright. She's a great spokesperson. Len, you note the development of new abilities. Now, you mentioned here the great performers David Copperfield and Chris Angel with their remarkable performances/feats. Do you believe here that there's a question of increased ability, perhaps?
Well, those photos that I included in that chapter of Chris Angel's floating in the air, I mean, how can you argue with photographs and walking on water?
Mm-hmm.
I believe he knows how to levitate, but he's not going with it. He doesn't admit that.
Mm-hmm.
But the real story there is the story of the guy that was trained by the military and who developed superhuman capabilities.
Andy
Perro? That's the real story. Andy mm-hmm. Perro, yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real story
mm-hmm.
there. The fact that they started coaching him from the age of 5 or 6 and developed him into a superhuman or a super soldier. Basically, I was using that chapter to show the fact that we do have that potential. And basically, it's an argument against the aliens' claim that the only way we can improve is by genetic tinkering, producing hybrids. And I'm taking the position that that's not the case, that the human race will eventually develop superhuman capabilities, both mentally, psychically, and physically, because that's our future. And that's really where we're headed. And we've already gotten many examples of it, and I just simply used Chris Angel and Andy Perro as an example of the fact that's where that's going. You know, the fact that the aliens claim the only way we're going to improve is through genetic development of a hybrid race, I'm taking issue with that. I don't believe that's the case. I think that they have their own agenda in terms of the development of the hybrids. And, of course, the hybrid program has definitely been going on for quite a long time now. I think you may have realized that I wrote the story about Steven Spielberg's television series Taken, where he
yes.
talked about that at length. So, you know, there's no doubt about that, no doubt whatsoever.
That was very interesting material. And, you know, here we have the most senior in expertise and information researcher here in the room mentioning that we're a hybrid race. Interesting point.
That we are
that humans are a hybrid race. Mm-hmm.
Well, the aliens claim that that the human genome has been tinkered with many times. Who did the tinkering? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Some will say the Pleiadians might have done it. Some would say perhaps the Andromedans. Then, of course, we have the Syrians involved.
Mm-hmm.
So, who's in control of this process? I don't know. I don't know. I do think that there has been a lot of genetic manipulation been going on over a very, very long period of time.
And certainly a subject matter well worth a study. It would be of prime importance to humans to know those answers. Now, you know, Len, I'm particularly am interested in the discussion regarding World War II, that conflict could have entailed a conflict between extraterrestrial parties as well. Now, you know that Hitler may have been mentored by personalities deep in the occult, such as members of the, am I pronouncing it correctly, the Thule Vril Societies.
Thule.
And the
Thule Society, yeah.
Thule, thank you. Thule Vril Societies and the Green Dragon Society. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that there was definitely an ET connection with Hitler. There's no question about it. And as I said in the book, Branton, who wrote extensively on this subject, claimed that such a deal was made in 1933 between the Greys and between Hitler, and that explains the fact that he got his hands on some of this incredible technology, which could not have gotten any other way, really, that it was anti-gravity. They were developing anti-gravity craft as early as the 20s, and they had a huge 132-foot saucer developed by 1945, and they actually sent one to Mars. So, you know, there was definite ET involvement in World War II. There's no question about it, as far as I'm concerned. My belief is that the whole worldwide fascist movement was an ET attempt to basically enslave the planet. That's what it was all about. And if it hadn't been for the brilliance of Roosevelt and Churchill, and with some help from Nikola Tesla and others, we possibly could have lost. And thank God we didn't.
Amen to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned as well that you believe that Nikola Tesla would have had, might have had brilliant mind, and he might have received some information as well from beneficial ETs.
Well, he always claimed that he was getting help from his off-planet friends. He never made a secret of it. And he himself, my personal opinion is that I believe he himself was probably an extraterrestrial, because his brilliance was so far out of whack with anybody else's. He was so far away from anybody else's. I mean, that I don't see how he could have been native to this planet. Yeah, he probably did come from somewhere else. Maybe not by birth, but perhaps by spirit, so to speak.
Nope, interesting conjecture. And you know, Len, you referenced the Wonder Weapons or Wunderwaffe, and you also include in these Wonder Weapons, and I'm not pronouncing correctly, a Hanebu 3, HANEBU 3, a free energy craft with immense speed. Now, is that the craft that some report went to Mars?
That's the that three different models of that. There was a Hanebu 1, the Hanebu 2, and the Hanebu 3. And they got larger and larger and faster, and the one that developed in 1945 was 132 feet and had a crew of 32 and could leave the Earth's without benefit of rockets. So it makes sense that that could have easily have escaped the gravitational pull of the planet and gone to Mars. And that claim was made by Vladimir Trzeski, who had done a lot of research on the subject.
Yes, you mentioned that fellow, Vladimir Tuzinski, the physicist and engineer, the Bulgarian-born gentleman. Now, he also believes that a lunar base exists on the dark side of the moon, which was founded in 1942. That's interesting.
The existence of the moon, the moon base was developed in 1962. And mm-hmm. we also developed one on Mars in the same year.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Dean confirms that, and many others have confirmed that. Now it's now more or less become a widespread belief that we did have colonies on the moon and Mars in 1962.
Very intriguing information. Very intriguing reports there. Now, Lynn, that aspect of a Nazi gray base in Antarctica, that Neuschwabenland concept, what do you think of that?
Well, we know for a fact that Hitler was developing that Antarctic base from 1938. In 1938, that's before the outbreak of World War II, he was building submarines and large ships to Antarctica and developing that base under the ice. And that's why they made claim to that large part of Antarctica called Neuschwabenland. So the question is, why would the Nazis have been developing such a base halfway around the world while they were also preparing for World War II? I mean, it's mm-hmm. an incredible story, and yet there's no question about it that they were indeed doing that, and that they had an entrance to that base under the ice, and that there were warm water lakes down there that they had discovered. So the fact that he was moving men and materials there from the 30s on indicates that his interests were not only in winning the war, but that his real interest perhaps had something to do with outer space, and that's why they were developing the Antarctic base. Now, I think you've heard of probably of Project High Jump, have you not?
No, I haven't. Please inform.
Well, we sent a fleet of 13 ships, including an aircraft carrier, 4,700 Marines, destroyers, down to Antarctica in 1946.
Oh.
To destroy that Nazi base because we found out about it.
Pardon the interruption. Was Admiral Byrd? Admiral Byrd was there too?
Admiral Byrd was one of the leaders of that, as well as Captain Cruzan, and also Chester Nimitz, who was a World War II hero, as you probably know. They were all involved in that. And that attack was supposed to have been a six-month effort. We were confronted with saucers that came out of the water and literally destroyed one of the destroyers and forced us to retreat. And so they aborted the mission 3 months early. And Admiral Byrd talked about it freely afterwards on board a ship in Chile. But when he got back to the United States, he was silenced. They wouldn't let him mm-hmm. talk about it anymore. So that would all argue for the fact that that base did indeed exist, and what the Nazi intent was, we don't know. But most likely, that base was jointly developed with the aliens, with the alien race that he was allied with. That would appear to be the case.
Intriguing information. I also was a bit shocked when I heard that some believe that there was the cloning of stormtroopers. That was one possibility for the tremendous number of figures. I don't know. That to me sounds very conjectural, but what do you think of that?
Well, that's probably the most controversial claim in
yes.
my book. But, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's based on a lot of facts that quote by Hitler that I have in that chapter that he claims
yes.
that he conjures entire divisions out of the ground. He made that quote, and it was witnessed by his butler.
Mm-hmm.
And Stalin got his hands on that quote. And that's why it's in that book called The Hitler Book. But, you know, he couldn't have developed that huge Wehrmacht army of his so fast, because he took power in 1933, and the treaty that ended World War One prohibited him from having any army over 100,000 men.
Mm-hmm.
And yet in 1934 he had 116 stalwart young soldiers standing at attention at the rally in Nuremberg. Now, where did
mm-hmm.
they come from?
Yes.
And then he later admitted that he'd kept those 21 divisions under wraps. He made that admission in 1935. And he said, I have another 21 divisions coming. So putting it all together, and putting the fact that this German army was, in a way, it was kind of superhuman. They were fearless, and they could be sent to their death easily by you know. So there's no question about it that something strange was going on there. Certainly Hitler could not have expected to take over the world with the dispirited army he had left after World War One. It just didn't make sense.
You know, Len, I'm noticing some excellent comments here in the room, again by one of our a fine researcher there of ICAR, who states, beautifully said, that Hitler was a cruel, evil bastard, yet he did things at a time when it wasn't possible. All of his science was dispersed to the world. Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And more and more as I reflect on what happened in World War II, I do see that the worldwide fascist movement was an attempt to basically enslave the planet. And that was Hitler's intent. And it all worked out. They had it all worked out, where the Japanese would take over the oceans because of their incredible imperial fleet, and Hitler and Italy would divide up the land masses. So it was a real turning point in the history of this planet. No question about it.
Agree with you. Now, Len, you've thoroughly studied. This is often another subject matter. You've thoroughly studied the Edgar Cayce material at the Library of the Association for Research and Enlightenment in Virginia Beach. Len, are there any particular Cayce concepts that strike you as most relevant to these coming years? Do you think Atlantis is of relevance?
Absolutely, yeah. Atlantis is definitely relevant. I think you might recall that in my chapter on Adamski, in his conversation with the extraterrestrial, the ET verified the fact that he believed that reincarnation was a fact. And Cayce talked about reincarnation extensively, and talked about many of the people who he gave readings to had lived on Atlantis in previous lifetimes. I don't have any trouble with that at all. It all makes sense to me, and the fact that an extraterrestrial validated it just makes it all the more believable, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, that Orthon.
Okay.
No, very well said there.
Orthon, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, Len, you are very much involved in the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP, in the Washington area in the 1960s. What from these most impressed you, or do you most remember, as far as the experiences there in Washington, the reaction of both the government and the citizens?
Well, you know, we had some top people at NICAP at that time. Admiral Helen Carter was on the board of directors, and you may recall that he was also a member of MJ-12, and he wrote a letter to the president urging them to disclose the UFO information. But what made NICAP so outstanding was the fact that they did some very careful field investigations and developed some really incredible documentation and proofs that they gave to the press. If they hadn't been so disciplined about their research, that never would have happened. I believe that because of that, because the press was releasing this information that they were getting from NICAP, that it literally embarrassed the government into doing their own program, which became Project Blue Book. And as we all know now, that, of course, turned out to be a whitewash. It was a way of disproving it and make, uh, disparaging it. But if it hadn't been for NICAP, I don't think that they would have even been moved to do that. There were some very, very bright people involved in NICAP, and T. Townsend Brown, who we discussed earlier, was the founder of NICAP. So that tells you a lot right there.
Yes, it does. And, you know, you mentioned the fact the very professional, very organized protocol there for reporting and compiling the information on the sightings really made NICAP the nation's chief source of information during that period.
That's correct. That's right. And all their files were then taken over by the QFOS in the 70s after NICAP dissolved. But while it existed, it was a very important, very, very important. And being there in the nation's capital, it was very well placed to do the research and to make the connections that were needed. So, and I happened to be there at that time, which was really great. I was right in the middle of it all.
That would be very memorable, definitely time and efforts well spent.
Absolutely.
Lynn, do you think, I usually ask my guests this, and I always learn from their responses. What do you think about the feasibility of disclosure? Do you think it's already occurred because so many contactees and researchers are presenting their evidence, their reports? What do you think of disclosure?
I don't think that the government is ever going to disclose, not our government. I think the other governments of the world have already done it. England, France, Brazil, even China's talking about it, you know. But I don't think there, and this is, but the United States is the most important one because so much of the work has been done here. But I don't think our government is ever going to do it. It's just become too big an event, and there's too much to admit to, and they're not going to admit to it. We've been dealing with ETs for 60 years now. How are they going to explain all that? So I think the only way it's going to happen is if the ETs take matters into their own hands and they have a mass landing. Now, will they do that? They're not likely to do that until we on this planet have developed a little higher consciousness, but we're not ready for that yet. For there to be a mass landing, they'd have to be greeted by a human race that has evolved a little higher in terms of consciousness. And that's the message that so many channelers are getting, that they're hoping that we can grow in consciousness to the point where we can meet with them on equal terms. And I think that's the only way it's going to happen. I don't think the government's ever going to acknowledge or disclose.
Well, it's a very reasonable scenario you present. Thank you. Now, we've got another question coming in from our Lily from New York. New York Lily wonders, what do you think, Len, of Annie Jacobson's book saying that the Roswell crash and bodies were staged by the Germans and Russians, and the bodies were genetically engineered deformed children?
It's ludicrous, absolutely ludicrous. I mean, Don Schmidt thinks so. Anyone who knows anything about Roswell will tell you that it's the most ludicrous explanation. That's even worse than the crash dummies. You know, everyone thought the crash dummies was kind of ridiculous. And then, of course, came Nick Redfern with his theory that they were prisoners, Japanese prisoners of war, who were disfigured and deformed, and we had kept as prisoners and using them in high space in outer space experiments. But this one takes the cake. First of all, the Russians didn't have anything that could be They didn't have any self-guided craft in 1947. They didn't have anything like we have the drones now. They had nothing like that. Secondly, it wouldn't make sense that the Russians would expect such an event to panic the American people when they knew very well that the military would keep it a secret. So what's the point? What's the point? They must have known that it would not get out to the public. So how could they expect it to create a panic like the War of the Worlds? That's what she said, isn't it? Isn't that what she said in the book?
I haven't read the book, and I will do so.
None of it makes sense. Mm-hmm. And she got all this from one single source, she said, from one person. So I think it's a pretty risky proposition to be putting out there.
Yes, yeah. I think with the contention that would be that controversial. You really need multiple resources, and I appreciate New York Lily's reading it. I definitely will get a copy. I think it's well worth the read, but if only to disprove what's being said in it. Funny, initially it was being heralded by some as an interesting expose on current events in the UFO field or events within the last century, but that does sound like
in her interview with Jon Stewart on the Daily Show, she did mention the fact that this proposition about the Russian venture was only a very small part of the book, and that most of the book is really an expose of Area 51.
Area 51.
So from that standpoint, it's probably worth reading because she did put together compile a lot of information about Area 51, and that's probably the best part of the book, and that's a good reason to read it. But this thing about the Russians sending over thing to Roswell, that's ludicrous. It's really ridiculous. I don't think she believes it herself, frankly.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a very reasonable assessment. Thank you. Now, Len, do you feel that metaphysics can present an important informational tool to the study of ufology and ETs, for example, on the point of dimensionality? Also, do you feel that any extraterrestrial disputes can reflect not only a physical dimension, but a spiritual dimension as well?
I don't think there's any question that the aliens have the ability to move in and out of dimensions. You know, Bob Dean has talked about it. Many people have talked about it. Many of the abductees have talked about the fact that they could see that the aliens could shift in and out of dimensions. They can come into physicality. They can go out of physicality. They travel on time. Absolutely, until we begin to understand the multidimensional universe, we're not going to be able to understand the aliens. And that's what I meant before when I said that there's no point in the aliens disclosing themselves to us because we're not going to be able to comprehend the phenomenon. We're just not there yet. We're not able to understand the multidimensional universe. And they are very comfortable moving in and out of dimensions. So until we've got that down pat, I don't think that contact is going to do us any good.
You know, that's well said. Do you think as well, and you referenced earlier, the possibility, or actually some of the researchers now, believing that the Sphinx, the Great Pyramids, are from a date from a far earlier age, do you think that any new discoveries in that area, whether the Great Pyramids or Luxor or any of those key sites, might have relevance to us in the study of ET in our own history?
Well, I made that point in my chapter on Robert Bovall.
Yes.
He basically acknowledged that he thought that the Great Pyramid of Giza and the Sphinx were probably based on ET technology. And because the pyramid texts were very astronomical in everything that they talked about.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about it, and it all ties in with what von Daniken has been talking about. Lately, however, there's been a lot of talk about the fact that there is a Stargate in Giza. Whether we have the ability to use it yet, I don't know, but several people have mentioned the fact that there is a Stargate in Giza and that there's a capability of going through that Stargate to another star system. And perhaps that's how the original aliens got here in the first place. So whether that's true or not, I'm just throwing it out there as something that people are talking about now.
Do I remember it correctly that there was that reference that the Book of the Dead really has a more of a not actually a literal significance by any means, but a much more instructional, directional,
exactly
informative material
than Bovall said. Bovall said that in my interview with him. He said, really, they're astronomical. What they're talking about is in the book of the Dead is they're talking about astronomical revelations, and that has to do with star travel, and that the fact that the Pharaoh was able to travel to the stars, and so that would tie in with the fact that perhaps they knew about that Stargate, and perhaps they developed that Stargate. So, you know, have you heard of Andrew Passaggio? Who is?
Yes, I have. Yes, he's an attorney. Is it from the West Coast? I believe he's a proponent that there is definite signs of life on Mars as in sentient.
Right. He claims that teleportation is a fact, and he knows it for a fact that it does exist, and he himself has been teleported. So the existence of stargates and the existence of teleportation, I'm sure you've heard about the Montauk experiments.
Yes.
I'm convinced that all does exist and that we know how to use it. Certainly the military knows how to use it. What they're doing with it, of course, I don't know. Who knows?
Hmm. Well, interesting a thought for study there, for conjecture. Now, can I ask you a question, Len? Your research is extensive. It's very thought-provoking. You write beautifully. What are new subjects of study for you in this field?
Did you say new subjects?
Yes. Mm-hmm. A current project
that
I'm viewing. Mm-hmm.
I think that the Serpil story deserves further explanation and further study because it really is a very big story. If we did indeed send 12 astronauts to the planet Serpo in 1965, that tells you an awful lot about where we were in terms of development at that point and what we knew and what we didn't know. So I'm thinking that I really would like to expand on that and perhaps make that into a book, and that's what I'm working on right now. There's a lot of materials that has come out subsequent to that the original revelations that I'd like to try and put it all together.
And also that reference to the extensive material at that facility would make a fine subject of assessment and trying to determine just what is in those reports.
Exactly. Yeah, it's an amazing story and. You know, these 12 very brave people that would volunteer or would go on this journey, it would make a lot of the Hollywood movies that we've already seen pale by significance. It really is quite a story. So I'd like to expand on that and get into that in more detail.
Well, it definitely sounds like an excellent reading material to me. I definitely will be one of the first to read it. Now, Len, where your expertise extends to metaphysical philosophy, also these ufology and ET subject matters, do you think that really it's only with that entire spectrum that you could appreciate the full significance of the UFO-ET presence?
Well, as I said on my website, I don't think anyone can really understand the UFO phenomenon without having some background in metaphysics. Because the aliens can wink in and out of dimensions. They have abilities that we couldn't possibly comprehend unless we understood metaphysics. Subjects like reincarnation have to be taken into account. We're hearing stories of the fact that they have the technology to actually take a soul out of a body. I mean, you know, these are incredible stories, and if we don't have some grounding in metaphysics, and I think you can get that from the KC material, You're never going to understand it. You're just never going to understand it. I think it's an absolute mm-hmm. necessity.
Well done, and I heartily agree with you. Excellent points. Now, Len, we're approaching the end of the program. I want to thank you for this informative discussion. I hope you will definitely be a return guest to this program in the very near future. And wonderful, I also want to reference again your website, which is, let me see here, don't tell me I've lost the first page. Oh, here it is, www.et-secrethistory.com. And at that site you'll find ordering information for his book, The Secret History of Extraterrestrials, Advanced Technology, and the Coming New Race. Definitely an excellent book to read. Very informative, and even some of the material may be a bit conjectural, but it is based on excellent research. The points are well made. It's definitely a very worthwhile read. You're a fine writer and researcher, Len. Now,
thank
I also
you.
Want to thank... And it said very sincerely, sir, I learned a great deal, and I think that that book is excellent. Now, I hope you will again be a return guest. And right now, I want to turn to the audience and say thank you for listening to this program. Your input is appreciated. I hope everyone has a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. And thank you for listening to the program tonight. Wonderful night all. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot, Patrice. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Len. I appreciate your being a guest. Wonderful weekend. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.